This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement. And as we head into the second international break of the season in the Sky Bet Championship, it's congratulations to Bournemouth who lead the way. And after West Brom's first defeat of the season, are the only unbeaten team left in the whole of the EFL. In Sky Bet League One, Wigan Athletic have retaken top spot after their sixth win in seven. And in Sky Bet League Two, seven wins in their 10 matches so far mean that Forest Green Rovers are still out in front. And with a very much curtailed EFL fixture programme this coming weekend, this is going to be a very different episode of the official EFL podcast. So, what we thought we'd do on this episode is delve into exactly what it's like to be an EFL manager, to carry the hopes and the dreams of a town or a city on your shoulders. What are you thinking when thousands of supporters are scrutinising and questioning your every move? Just who would want to do one of the most precarious jobs in the country? Well, here are three I prepared earlier. From the Sky Bet Championship, Swansea City head coach Russell Martin. From Sky Bet League One, the Rotherham United manager Paul Warne. And from Sky Bet League Two, the Stevenage manager Alex Revelle. Let's just do the dynamics first of all. Who knows who and all that kind of stuff. So, Alex, who you obviously were with Warney briefly at Rotherham.
Luckily enough that we got to play together, I think. Or lucky for Warney anyway. And then I think when he became coach there, I was still a player. So I was lucky enough to see him there. And then obviously just with Russ, lucky enough to meet him. Playing against him, but obviously then when he took charge at MK Dons, we met up a few times just to discuss becoming a manager, and he helped me in my path the way that I've gone now. So I'm lucky enough to know them both.
Luckily enough, I mean, those are compliments we're getting in here already. And Russ, I'm guessing you and Warney have faced each other a couple of. Have you faced each other?
We have.
Yeah, it's just with Warney going up and down the leagues every season, it's very difficult for any of us to keep.
If we last as long as Warney, we've done all right. So
yeah, well, I'm sure that's one of the talking points we're going to be bringing into this. How do you feel, Warney, about sort of sharing your innermost thoughts? Are you always sort of message aware, being cautious of the fact supporters will be listening and picking holes and things?
No, obviously I'm very loose, aren't I? So whatever pops into my head, I'll say. So no, I'm absolutely fine sharing.
Yeah, no, that's really good. Right, listen, no apologies. Want to get inside your heads. Russ, I want a personal sentence to describe what it is like to be a football manager.
It is intense. It's challenging. It can bring moments of real joy and beauty and real connection, but it can be really lonely at times as well, and quite difficult. But it's a job I really, really enjoy.
Oh, we're going to strip that one down for sure. Paul, are you going to add anything to the mix?
It's a good start, that, by the way. It sounds
really
well prepared.
Good, isn't it?
I feel like I'm just talking now to give Alex some chance to think of something better.
You could see my brain. You could see me there thinking, couldn't you?
I was thinking, wow, he started well there. We should have done reverse order. You've gone champ, and there's a reason. I would say it's just all consuming. That's how I would put it.
Okay. And Alex, you've had long enough, mate.
I think the first word that popped into my head was roller coaster. I think that, you know, like, it's all emotions that Ross said, really. When you win, you enjoy the wins. It's also relief when you win. So, and then automatically you think about the next game. So, roller coaster, or the same exactly what Warne said, is consuming as well. So, takes over your life, but, you know, we're lucky enough to be in a position to do it. So, you have to enjoy it as well.
Yeah. Okay then, Paul. So what, describe the feeling of a high then. Can you put it into terms the everyday man can correlate with?
Well, I don't think it's a lot different than being a fan, really. When we score a goal and it goes in and you see the terracing going crazy, I think that is all the emotion we feel inside. So, for example, if we scored from a set piece late in a game and we'd worked on it for hours, not hours, but a long period of time, and the delivery was perfect, the block was perfect, the connection was perfect, it went in, you get an immense feeling of pride, and you're happy with the coach who's like, it'd probably been Hammy who worked on the attack and set piece. But when the ball actually hits the net, it is 3, 4, 5 seconds, you've just lost yourself, like you do when you're a player and you score, when you do when you're a fan, or when you watch England play, or whatever the case may be. So the pure abandonment of your thoughts is exactly the same. I'm not one of them who a goal goes in and then straight away I'm pointing to my forehead and pointing to my centre half, pretending all, you know, tune in. I've lost myself for a few seconds. I don't jump around like a lunatic, but in my head, I am beyond, you know, beyond happy. And even more so, if we're 2-0 up with a minute to go, I'll turn and speak to Richie and go, look, even we can't mess this up, mate. There's only 50 seconds left now. And that final, that when that whistle goes, it's an that is an immense feeling. And I always struggle with it because when the final whistle goes, all I want to do is hug all my staff. However, I know that the other dugout are kindly walking to meet us, and you feel like you just got to get there and shake hands with them first, because when you're the manager walking over after a defeat and all their benches celebrating, it is pain beyond pain. You just, it's the walk of shame, we call it, really. So when things go great, I think it's just the same as it is for being a fan, but just probably multiplied a little bit more.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I mean, Russ, because in addition to the jubilation of the attachment to the team, it's an endorsement of your personal work, isn't it? Of your strategies, of your values, of your beliefs?
I think so, yeah. I think the team is a reflection of what the manager believes in, I guess. A reflection of your personality. I think teams often end up, if you really broke it down, they end up reflecting what is most important to the manager, what they prioritise. So, yeah, it becomes really personal. And you feel, like Warnie said, you feel so responsible for the people you work with, not just the players on the pitch, the guys that are left in the stand who all want to be on there. You feel a certain amount of guilt throughout the week that maybe you haven't dedicated enough time to certain staff because it's just so much to do. So all of them feelings that come to fruition on a Saturday, and at the end of it, we are not judged annually, quarterly. We're judged every single game. So it's 3 days in between sometimes. And so it does become really consuming, and you have to be respectful, like Warnie said, of what the other manager's going through, what the other bench are going through. So yeah, it's just so much to think about. But like Warnie said, after the final whistle goes, you've won or you scored a goal. It is, and that's what I was talking about, moments of like beauty and it's just elation. It's great. But you do go through so much. But like Rev said at the start, you have to remember what you are here for, what you really believe in, and feel grateful for it, because there's plenty of people who really want to be in the jobs that we're in.
Go on then, Russ. So the pain, though, the opposite side of this, the pain of something going wrong, the pain of defeat in a crucial game as a manager.
Yeah, it feels worse than a player. I think as a player, I always had the mindset that I prepared everything I possibly could during the week as well as I could. So if I played poorly on a Saturday and we lost, it's, you know, I couldn't really do anything about it. When you're a manager, you start making up 101 things you could have done about it, could have done, but time is of the essence. You don't have enough time to do everything and be everything. It's impossible. So you prioritise what's really important to you. And if you come undone with something that you feel maybe you missed, or you got a decision wrong, a selection decision wrong, you should have made a sub. You know, there's so many variables. There's so much randomness in football. And when you lose a game, you start questioning everything and anything. And then it's about trying to take some time to remain sane and grounded and go back to what's really important.
I mean, the cliche, Revs, is obviously it's like a dagger to the heart, and that it sits over you and you go home and kick the dog and kick the cat. Obviously, if anybody's listening from sort of pet protection, we don't mean that literally. But is it that pain just sits with you and permeates every walk of your life?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's as soon as you have a defeat, I think it's straight away in your mind, you're thinking, how do you then go and deal with a changing room? Is it... how do you address the players? Because it's whatever you do in that moment is going to affect maybe the Monday when you come in, or the next day. It's going to affect the mood within the whole place. It's, you know, you go home, you've got your kids and your wife who, you know, they're just as disappointed as you are because they know how hard you work. And I think that the biggest thing that kind of people who have been in the as a manager a long time have said, you can never get too high or too low. And it's very, very tough because I think that as a player, you used to go home and it would hurt you for that night, but then you'd move on because you know there's another game. As a manager, you, like Russ said, you end up thinking, right, what have we done wrong potentially? Could we have done anything different? How do we now adapt next week to make sure it doesn't happen again? You're constantly thinking, it never leaves you. You know, I think that, you know, when even when you go to sleep, you're thinking about the things that you can change. So it does consume you, but the best thing about football is that you get another opportunity, whether it 3 days or seven, you get another opportunity to change it. And that's how you have to think, I think.
Yeah, I think Paul is signalling to me that he wants to discuss this particular topic, but he was already doing it with the scowl he was wearing on his face in kind of synchronised sympathy with you there, Revs.
Yeah, well, what both have said, it's just that when you're a player and you play on a Saturday and you lose and you've given your best, and even as a player, if you've made a mistake, you sort of blame someone else. You can blame a coach or I didn't get told that information or anything. But as a manager, it is disgusting. And if you concede a goal like last minute, like we conceded a goal against Crewe for a draw the other week and we played really well, the best we played all season and we drew. And you're walking off the pitch as the manager, you're getting a little bit of booing or a little bit, you can see discontent from fans. They're as disappointed as you are. And I always try and give the lads 5 minutes before I go in, so I'm not emotional when I speak to them. But it's very difficult. It's very difficult to be objective because you've been standing on the side of the pitch and you really want to watch the game back before you feed back to the lads, but you can't because they need to see, they want to see you. They want, so you try and calm down. You try and I agree what both say, you know, you've got to detach yourself from it, but it's so difficult. Then you go out and someone sticks a microphone in your face. So what went wrong today, Warnie? And sometimes nothing's gone wrong. The opposition are just better. That can sometimes simply be the case. But then you've got to prepare the team for the next game and you're thinking, right, what changes do I need to make? But sometimes the best team had already played for you. You don't need to change anything. And that's the hardest thing for management, I think, because there's all these external voices and advice and anyone down the shop can say to you, why don't you play him? And you're like, oh. And like when we drew to Crewe the other week, to put it in a context for people who aren't a football manager, when I got home, I wasn't best pleased. I wasn't in a good mood. I needed a bit of time away from my family, which sounds awful, but I just needed to take my dog out, who's my saving grace. So I go with my dog. He's wagging his tail. He doesn't care, does he? He's buzzing that I'm just there. He don't care if we lost 6-0. Like, he's my mate. So I'm walking over, just chatting to him because I've got another game in a few days' time. And coming the other way is a Rotherham fan in a Rotherham shirt. And I'm like, oh, no. And as I get close to him, he went, oh, what do you think? And I can't be rude. And I went, well, I thought we played excellent. He went, yeah, but you know what happened at the end of the game? And I can't really explain it to you. Well, I could. And it's just, you know, wherever you go as a football manager, and I appreciate it's a really privileged job, but everyone sort of wants a piece of your mind, you know, a little bit of, what did you think? You know, the owner wants to know where it went wrong. The players want to know. The players who aren't in the team then think that they should be in the team. Even my missus said to me the other week when I took Smudge off, what are you taking Smudge off for? And I'm like, look, Rach, I don't need you telling me who my best centre forward is. But, and that's the whole consuming thing is. And that's how it is. So like for me, and I don't know if I speak for the other two here, but even if we win, you get that little bit of euphoria for about 20 minutes where, like, you fit. I don't know if anyone's listening to this and ever been a best man. So if you ever do a best man speech, you get all that nervousness beforehand. You do the best man speech, you thought, oh, that went well. Then after the best man speech, you think, oh, I feel great now. Now, if you had to do a best man speech again for someone else in 3 days' time, you'd be, oh, I'm going to have to start working on the next best man speech. And that's what a football manager's like. You get, you know, that massive high when you win, or massive, you know, low if you lose. But and then you have to go again. And you have to go again. And you have to motivate your staff. You don't want your staff to see you disappointed. You have to motivate your players. You have to but you have to, you know, put it in a way that your chairman understands it without being too curt about it. And you have to do it in your press so the fans understand, the players listen to your press, your owner listens to your press. And you've got all this going on all the time with a game, like 3 days, 4 days, 7 days, win, lose. And that's what makes being a manager, I think, a more difficult job than people think.
Yeah. Is this quite cathartic, Russ, to listen to Warnie talk like this and realise you're not alone? Because you painted quite a lonely picture a little while back during this chat, that others are going through exactly the same thing.
I didn't mean you can be lonely, that moment of you feel totally responsible. But yeah, what Warnie talked about, and he explains it brilliantly, it's just so much. It's just, there's so much to do constantly. There's never a time to really switch off. And then you get to the summer break, and then it's not like you can switch off again. It's, you need to get ready for the next season and analyse the previous season. Where can we improve? How do we? What do we need to recruit? How are we doing it next season? What are we going to change? So, yeah, it's just constant. And you're ever evolving. You're always learning about yourself, about the people you have with you. But yeah, I didn't mean to, like, you're never alone. You feel like that when you are, when you've just lost a game, and it's because of the responsibility. But we all have brilliant people around us that we really trust and we really lean on. But those people, we are also, we're responsible for them, because if it doesn't go well, we're the people that are in the firing line. And unfortunately for people you work with, some of them are gonna, you know, they're with you, their allegiance is with you, their loyalty is with you, and of course you feel the weight of all that as well at times. But he explained it brilliantly, Warnie, fantastic. And obviously he's been doing it for longer than we have, so he's been through it all over and over again. And the fact that it takes a certain person to be able to find the energy to keep doing it, because I think the one thing it does take, which is so important, and when you go for your coaching badges and everyone says you need to manage yourself before you can manage anyone, because you need energy constantly. I'm really conscious the first person that comes in the office, the last person that comes in at the end of the day gets the same energy as the first person. And that's not always easy. When you've had a draining day, you've had a lot of dialogue, a lot of conversation, you're analysing things, you may be off the back of a bad result, you've maybe not seen your kids as much as you want that week or that day. So all of that comes into play, but you have to remember that the people that are in your office, when they leave, they're going to feel something. And you have to try and make sure they feel the right emotion as well. So you have to be conscious of so much. So it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I don't want us to sit here and, like, it's not a pity party. Warnie will tell you about all the brilliant things as well, but we're talking about the difficulty of it and how it can be, and it is tough. But yeah, I think we wouldn't do it if the feeling that you have of the brilliant moments, the stuff you really enjoy doing, the stuff that gets your juices flowing on the training pitch with the players, in the analysis room, on the match day, all of that outweighs the other stuff. Otherwise, no one would do it. We just wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Of the sort of, I guess, three parts, Alex, that's managing up to the owner of the club, the players, which in themselves, I guess you can't do it collective all the time. It's got to be individual sometimes. And then the supporters. Which of those three elements is the hardest to manage?
I think managing expectations of the managing up and fans, I think...
Are they too high? Are they just too high across the board? Do you think just generally everybody's expectation in football is 6 rungs, 8 runs, 10 rungs up the ladder higher than the club actually is in its natural order?
Well, I think everybody wants to get promoted. Everybody wants to be at the top of the league. They want to, you know, they want to get to the Premier League. I think the biggest thing we've found of where we are is the players' ambitions. I think that's one big thing that we've had to deal with this year in terms of challenges. I think people maybe at League Two sometimes set themselves too lower ambition. And I think that, you know, as a football club, you know, we have finished, you know, we want to be higher than where we are, and we expect a lot. And I think the biggest thing is ambition. And we've set real targets this year for the players, for the staff as well, for everybody to go out there and have ambition, because without it, success is really, really tough. So to manage those expectations of above us and the fans, we have to want that. Managing the players for me has been fine. I think that I'm relatively new to retiring, so I think that I like to think that I'm kind of
down with the kids.
Yeah, down with the kids, exactly. So I think that I'm I can deal with that, and I think that managing upwards for yourselves is always a challenge, because when you lose, like Russ said earlier, you've got a lot of people that want a piece of you, want to understand what's gone wrong. When you're winning, it's well done. When you're losing, it's, you know, it's how can we improve, and you need to get better. So it's managing those and managing your time with those to make sure that they understand where you are and what the football club's doing, I think.
I go ask all of you about sort of hitting the ground running, and I will start with you, Alex, because obviously you inherited a situation. I think you were the fourth manager of the season, weren't you, if my memory serves me right, the season before last. So, you know, yeah. Dino Marmory is there, Graham Wesley comes in, Mark Sampson gives it a go, and finally it drops to you. That moment when you're in charge, just come out of the youth teams, fledgling manager, what on earth is going through your head?
I think I was one of the only managers that was hoping that COVID was going to stop the season, I think, to be honest with you.
Very honest.
It was a tough time. And I think then in my first job, then all of a sudden to manage everything with COVID, I don't think I would have faced many more challenges, to be honest with you. But I think for me, it was real excitement because... like Russ and Warney both said, like you are in charge of so many people, and it does take certain types that can do it. It depends, you know, if you're organised, you might be someone who's really organised, and that's what you do, or you might be someone who people look to with your enthusiasm. And I think that's what I am. And I think probably Warney is probably like that as well. And so is Russ, because we're passionate about what we do. So it's something that I really wanted to get into. So to be able to have the challenge, I wanted to take that step up. And the first thing we had to do was release 25 players. That was my first job as manager. So which you have to do. And they're parts that when you get on your badges, you don't learn about. Emotion, you don't learn about, you know, having to tell people that that's the end of them earning money. And at our level, it's mortgages. At our level, it's a massive, massive part of their lives. So you have to make sure you're ready for it. I felt ready for it. And then obviously, you know, with the success we had last year, to go from where we were signing players when we didn't have a clue what league we were in, signing Conference South players and National League because we thought that that's where we were going to be, to finish 14th at the end of the season was an incredible turnaround. So it's one that we're really proud of, and something that you can look back and I don't think I'll ever face a challenge like that again as manager. But then as you go higher up, pressure, expectations are a lot more than potentially where I am now. So it's a massive learning curve, something I'm learning every day. And I'm, you know, it's just take it step by step, and hopefully I can get to where the two other managers are that we're talking to today.
Or further. Warney, I mean, Kenny Jackett leaves, very much a surprise. They turn to you. You'd come an unorthodox route perhaps as well. You'd been behind the scenes at Rotherham. PE teacher. When did you do your teaching qualifications and things? Was that while you were in your playing career?
I did my degree before I became a player. Okay. So I didn't turn pro till I was 23. And I did my teaching degree when I was 36, I think. I finished it. And I finished playing when I was 39. So
you're in charge. All of a sudden, you know, Kenny Jackett's been appointed. He decides it's not for him for reasons we never really fully understood, did we? I still don't know to this day. But that maybe that's not the moment for this. We're going inside your heads. I don't know what signal he's making to me there, but let's just ignore him. Come on, what did you do? There you are. Right, go on, Warney, it's yours. Off you go.
Initially, it was only a caretaker thing. So it wasn't, you know, in fairness to the other two gentlemen on here, they went in as permanent managers, I think. So it would probably be a different mindset. But I'd come from a position of caretaker. I'd done it a couple of times with different people. And I honestly believed it was going to be caretaker again. So I didn't go in and change a lot. I just, truth be told, I went in and tried to treat the lads I'm a massive respect sort of guy, so I wanted the dressing room and the culture of the club to be right. So I just treated the lads right and just tried to get training in the way I thought it should be. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. We'll all have different ways that we coach and train. I'm obviously I'm a bit of a fitness freak, so I always want them to be fit and that. So I tried to change the training a little bit. And then I just thought it was just me holding the ropes really until someone came in and saved the day. I joked many times that I would turn up at the training ground and hope to see a 7 series pull in that was going to, you know, take the job off me, but that didn't happen.
And here we are all these years later, and promotions and relegations galore. I mean, your circumstances, Russ, which is you've prepared one team for the start of this current season, and then obviously this opportunity comes along and you find yourself supplanted into Swansea just a few days before the start of the season. You walk in front of the players for the first time. What are you thinking? What's coming out of your mouth?
Well, I knew three of the players. I played with them at Norwich. So Carl Norton, Ryan Bennett and Corey Smith. So I had chats with them the day before I came in, just to see what the players, where they were at, what the feeling was amongst the group. Really, it was really tough for me. It was bittersweet, really, because the opportunity is huge. And the more I spoke to the owners here and the guys in charge, it was became really difficult for me to turn down because of the alignment in the way that they wanted things done and the vision for the team. But I really found it difficult to leave MK because I felt so connected to the people I was working with, which is why I brought so many with me, which was another factor in me coming here because I was allowed to do that. The players I absolutely loved because we had them. It was a lot of change. We had a big turnover of players, but the group we had, we'd been together for 6 months to a year, a lot of them, and a lot of young guys that I felt really invested in. And I was planning to be at MK for a long time. You do. You plan to be at a club for a long time, otherwise it's completely pointless if you're planning week to week and you've got no big picture strategy. And I really felt we were progressing really nicely. We were in a really good place. We recruited really well in the summer. And it was really tough because I got supported really well by the supporters and the people around me. But the opportunity was too big. So when I came here, it was exciting. You step into the facility, you realise how big the training ground, the stadium, how big a club it is, how much it means to the people that work here. They're all fans, they're all supporters. So you feel the weight of it straight away, but it's a weight that I really enjoy, and an expectation I really enjoy. And also, we've been brought here not because we won things, but because of us, we do things in a certain way that they wanted us to bring here, which was brilliant. I wouldn't have just taken the job if it was it's because it's in the Championship. And yeah, the people that have been here from day one, like Revs, I'm not too well 2 years now, but I've not retired too long ago. So the players have been great. They've been really responsive, really receptive to what we want to do. And like Wally, I'm big on treating them with respect and being really honest with them. And that's been tough, some really honest conversation, especially with some of the guys that I know and know well, and people I've played against over the years a lot. But they've been brilliant, and we are really enjoying it.
But most of us, Clem, Ross. Clem, Brett.
You know when you said earlier about which one's harder to manage, upwards players or supporters? I think the Warney and Russ have said it. If you have that respect and honesty with players and above you, I think everything then becomes a lot easier. I think that's the big thing. I think when you've got that and you're honest and you have the respect of the people around you, all of that becomes a lot easier. And I think that's the way that I hope that I come across. I hope that's the way that, well, I know that both Paul and Russ do, because I've spoke to them both. If, you know, you have to get that, because, and then that's how you get success as a football club. When you get that honesty and, you know, the chairman knows and the people above know that they've got good people in charge that are trying to work as hard as they can for the football club, I think that automatically the players then buy into that, and then hopefully the supporters do. And I think it's, you know, hopefully that's what you try and create. It's like the ultimate cake, isn't it, of success. And what we're trying to do is put the little bits on top, I suppose.
The honesty cake, I like it.
Yeah. I think John Still, who I admire a great deal, in our 2,000 games as a manager with all his non-league stuff, he talks about the cake as ingredients of a team, doesn't he? So, you know, you can have the best eggs, you can have the best flour, but if you ain't got any water to bind it all together, you ain't got a team. Did you have any sort of act-as-if moments, Russ? You know, you're coming out of your comfort zone of what you know, and you're going in front of a completely new squad. Most of us, if we're swapping jobs or going into a situation where we don't know a lot of people, would maybe have to have one of those moments where we make ourselves big and give ourselves a talking to. Do football managers go through similar sort of emotions on certain occasions?
I think we all feel uncomfortable at times. I think, yeah, I think we have to. I think if you care about something, you have to accept there's moments of pain, and you have to find pleasure in amongst the pain. And being uncomfortable is something that I was pretty much most of my career, playing at a level I was. And coming here, I didn't feel uncomfortable. So, like I said, I had the team of guys with me that I really love working with and trust. I think whenever you go in front of a new group of players, that first time is probably the worst. And once you've done that, I think it gets much easier. But it's not one that, you know, you're filled with dread and you're not looking forward to. I think we all become used to speaking to a group of people, and whatever level, nothing really changes. They're all human beings. These guys, I think the difference between the players I worked with before and these guys is I'm dealing with some really experienced people that have earned a lot of money, which can change the dynamic a little bit compared to the guys at MK. But they what I found out really quickly is actually, no, they're the same. They're guys that want to learn, they want to be treated with respect. And if you give them that and honesty, I think like we said earlier, it's honesty can be really painful, the chats you have, but it's better for everyone. It's better for everyone. Even if people don't like it, I think they respect it as long as you deliver it in a way that is fair and respectful. So, for me, look, like Warnie beating his chest there, you have to have moments like that where you have to, and it works in the other foot, where you feel so angry or frustrated and it's not the right time for the group. So it's about being really self-aware about what's needed at what time. And we're not always going to get it right, but you hope that the balance is tips in the favour that you get it right more often than not.
Well, I obviously agree with everything. And I think it's quite unique that us three are on here because I think we all think the same, really. And I think humility is key. And I think being honest with the group, I've sat in many dressing rooms, played for many different managers, and they come in and they say, we're going to do this, we're going to win every game. And they think, come on. And the lads can see through that straight away. So me personally, and this is how I would manage, or this is how I do manage, that I would rather the manager come in and say, look, this is how I want to play, or I'll get to know you over the next few days and weeks. All I can say is that I'll take a step towards you. You take a step towards me. I'll try and make you better. I always harp on about I'll try and make you a better person and a better footballer. I don't want to hang out with people I don't like. So, but we're always here for you. You know, the door's always open and everyone says that. And a lot of managers say that and the door's locked or they're hiding under the desk when you knock on the door, which is a classic. But I just think the lads want to play. The lads want to be their best version and the lads want to know that you can still improve them. So even if I signed a 34-year-old, I'd still say to them, look, I still think you're good at this, this, this and this. But fundamentally, if you're playing it in the third league in England, you haven't got everything sus. So I can help you on this possibly if you buy into it. And I just think that, you know, I've witnessed managers come in. In fairness, Neil Warnock was hilarious. He came in when he kept Rotherham up that season. And his speech to the lads was that, look, lads, I don't even know what I'm here for. But we'll have a good crack at it, won't we? And the lads just laughed. It doesn't have to be rocket science. I just think the lads appreciated the fact that he was like quite funny, quite laid back. And really, he said, look, we'll just give it our best effort to try and keep you up. Whereas other managers would come in and, you know, well, we're changing the laws, we're fine systems coming in. And like, I just think those days are sort of gone, really. I just think the lads, like I said, I just think being honest and showing them that you can. I always say to the lads, look, I when we lose, I always take the blame for it. I pick the team. I can make mistakes. I can pick the wrong team. I can pick the wrong tactics. I can make the wrong substitutions. But at that moment in time, I made it for the right reasons. And I think if you can just be like that with the lads, and I'm like that with the owner. I tell the owner when I got it wrong. I tell the owner, like last night on the drive home, we'd won 4-1 in the cup. He was over the moon that we'd won, and I told him I thought we were rubbish. I weren't happy with the performance. So I think if you have a relationship of pure honesty with everybody, then they're more likely to listen to you. So I mean, someone might quote me and say, oh, you lied and said it was 2002 and it was 2003. But if I ever do an interview, I never lie to the fans. I never pretend it was good when it wasn't. And I think if you have a trust as much as you can throughout the club, even when things are bad, they appreciate you trying to do the right thing. I think, I mean, I've took the club down twice. So, I mean, that's a skill on its own not to lose your job. So maybe that's due to the fact that I'm honest with the owner and I tell him every journey and where our problems are and what I've tried to do. So
That's just the way I do it.
That goes back to expectation as well. We were speaking about that earlier. I'm pretty sure, Warner, you don't lie to them and you set expectations pretty realistic so that when it when something happens, it's pretty close to what you expected or why it's happened. You understand the reasons why. And
yeah,
so
yeah, I agree. I mean, my expectations are where I think we should finish in the championship, and my owner's expectations stroke dreams are different. But, you know, I do every week, I do speak to them about the opposition, why we're playing this way, why I think this tactic will work, what their threats are, what our threats are. And, you know, sometimes, mate, you, as you well know, you could be the most organised, the fittest, the best culture, everything. However, the team at the other side of the changing rooms probably has exactly that as well and better players. So sometimes you have to hold your hands up and say, look, there's a reason why Man City are always in the top three, not because they have the lowest budget, because they have the best players in Europe. There's a reason why the top three teams in the champ at the moment, two are ex-Premier League. There's a reason for that. So, like, in fairness to Alex, on this screen now, Alex could be the best manager of the three of us. We don't know yet because, no disrespect to the Stevenage players, they might not be as good as the ones in the top. But it doesn't mean he's not a great manager. I think a great manager is the one who gets the most out of the group he has. Not by winning championships and winning, you know, awards, but just by getting the best out of them. So the best out of my group this year might be sixth, it might be first, I don't know yet. And the same with you, mate, you don't know. Mid-table for you this year might be a massive achievement. Top 10 might be, fourth bottom might be. It's all about where you are in the standings. But you get judged as a manager by where you finish. But within football, within this conversation, we all know how good we are because we all know the intricacies of the finances, the facilities, you know, we know everything. So, and that's why I think managers have a really good respect value of each other because we know how hard the job is.
Yeah.
I just want to drill back down into that sort of fan scrutiny in particular, Alex. It rather begs the question, if your average, I don't know, roofer was sitting on top of a gable end and he accidentally knocked the corner off a ridge tile and 20,000 people went screaming at him and shouting at. Rather begs the question, Alex, how he would cope.
I think that they wouldn't cope very well, would they? I think that's the, you know, they're humans at the end of the day. That, you know, every player is, it doesn't matter what you earn, it's ultimately they're applying their trade. And everyone has good days and bad days, and our job is to make sure that whenever they go on the pitch, they're as prepared as they can be, with a clear plan of the manager and that the players understand it. And I think that if you can do that and you put them in a good place, they stand a much better chance of not being affected by crowds and expectations. And I think that they will make mistakes, obviously. Every player does. And it's down to us. It's down to make for us to make sure that they go on there and play as well as they can. I think that, again, what we said, you know, being honest and having respect, they'll go onto the pitch. If you treat them how they want to be treated, they'll do everything they can for you as a manager. And I think that as long as the fans and we see that as staff, that's all you can ask. Warnie, you've got your hand up.
I'll let you come in, Warnie. I'll let you come in on condition that you share with us maybe the most ridiculous misconception a supporter has ever come to you with. Because obviously there's a culture in football of stuff that you can't share with the supporters sometimes. As honest as you all want to be, and you increasingly are, there are sometimes things that go on behind the scenes. I mean, do you get some truly ridiculous scenarios sometimes in terms of supporters' perceptions?
Not really. Our supporters are quite good. I think generally they are quite good. However, we've got a generation between the age of 12 and 25 who've only known success, like a new stadium, promotions into the championship. Whereas the fans at a certain age have known bad times, known League Two, known admins, known. So they accept it a little bit more. But what I wanted to say was about what we were saying about, you know, fans abusing players, whatever the case may be. Look, I think all of us on here have been players and we all like the emotion of football. We all love the screaming when it goes in, the screaming when it's a tackle, and none of us want that diluted. I think the thing is with, and myself, like, I'm a Pittsburgh Steelers fan, love NFL, I'm going Sunday, right? I'm going both Sundays, I love NFL, right? That's my get out. I love Pittsburgh Steelers, buzz off them, I have all the gear, I'm full kit, Wally, when I watch on a Sunday, Nacho's in one, Moretti in the other, right? Have a great time. However, loved them last year, and then this year they're not winning. Am I a happy guy? No, I'm not. So fans are allowed to be emotive, but after the game when we lose, I am devoed, but the next day I'm not. So my advice would be to any manager, if you read, listened to, spoke to anyone, within 3 or 4 hours of the game finishing, they're all, people are really emotive. It's the next day and the day after that people come back down to earth. And my mistake when I first took over is I was so trying to keep everyone happy. I would monitor Twitter, what fans were saying, what they thought of me, what they thought. And I was going crazy. That was the worst thing I could ever have done. I'm not like that now. I'm the complete opposite, unless I'm walking the dog and some people attack me. But generally speaking, but I think the fans' expectations are good. But the whole transfer window thing, oh my God, like there's 3 weeks left. You haven't signed a striker. Why don't you sign, you know, why don't you sign, I don't know, Messi? Well, that, no one said Messi, but you know what I mean? People saying things to you and you say, look, they're way out of our remit. They, why? Well, so-and-so in your league can sign them. Yeah, I know they can. And you can't sit down with a fan and say, look, they've got 20 grand a week for a striker. We haven't. And it isn't like you're not really promoting the club the way you want to either. So you can't really express the complete honesty. None of us can on the screen. Like, we'll all have problems and, you know, other clubs have different problems. But mostly fans are okay. But the transfer window thing is just out of this world. I had a little bit this year when one of my midfielders I had on loan didn't choose us and chose a club quite close to us. And the fans are like, well, why didn't he come back? If you were a good coach and a good manager and he played for you, why didn't he want to come back to you? And you sort of say, look, you know, Sheffield Wednesday and us, unfortunately, there is a, you know, there is, in the footballer's mind, they're not Rotherham United fans. They're lads who want to have the biggest career they can. And if the player and the agent thinks he's going to get good game time going there, playing in front of 30,000 fans, how can you step in his way? And that, sometimes that's difficult because fans see that, you know, you do love the club you work for. I love all my staff. And what Russell said earlier, you feel the pressure of everyone's mortgages. You feel everything. It's unbearable at times. But, you know, the players aren't Rotherham United fans. They enjoy playing for the club. They give their all while they're here, but they're entitled to move on and, you know, ply their trade somewhere else. And that's sometimes difficult to get across to fans. And that's why I hate it. If a player comes back and they get booed, oh, that drives me mental. I could walk around the whole stadium and say, look, hang on a sec. We were chairing these 2 years ago. He scored that great goal at Wembley. He didn't mean to, off his shin pad. And now we're booing Revs' back. Look, gives Revs,
I'd wait for that. I can't believe it's taken that long.
Wow. I know. That irritates me. That irritates me.
Listen, it's been an amazing insight. It's been really, really honest of you all. So I'm going to ask you a really challenging question. What could you be better at, Russ?
Loads of things. So many things.
You're all getting this question, guys, by the way.
Oh, Alex is last. He always gets the most time, I think.
I think I've become much better at finding balance with the family, especially on a Sunday, and trying and putting the phone away completely. And I need to get better at not responding to people straight away, that they can wait sometimes. And I need to win more games. There you go, Glenn. I need to get better at winning games of football.
You've nicked mine, Russ.
I thought you were making notes there, Alex, for a second. I'll come to you next, Alex.
No, I think for me, time management for me is huge. I think that you have to be organised and make sure that, you know, in the mornings you prioritise the things you need doing, because otherwise, you know, you get so many things in a day that can just take up every hour. So time management and organisation for me is something I have to definitely improve in. And like Russ said, just carry it on, sticking with the plan that you have and make sure you win more games.
Yeah. Apart from keeping up with your dog when you go for a walk, Warnie, what could you be better at?
I could definitely be better at coaching. I don't think I'm a great coach. I'm lucky that I've got really good coaches. I don't think I'm a great coach, and I talk myself out of it all the time. I might be taking a session and think, oh, this ain't the best, this. And then after, the coaches say, what was wrong with that? And I went, ugh. So I'm good at delegating. I think I'm very good at delegating. And also, I think I'm still not very good at delivering bad news. And this might sound like, if I'm dropping a player and I need to tell him, I think, right, I need to tell him by 9:30 because I'm doing the team meeting at 10:30. And then I'll make an excuse to put it off to 9:45. And then I'll probably have another nervous poo and put it off till 10:00. And I'm brilliant at putting things off. You know, like if my missus says, don't forget to do something, and I think, I'll do that tomorrow. And sometimes I run out of time. So I just I'm so emotionally connected to my players. Giving bad news is still not easy, and I need to get better. And the problem is, as you can well imagine listening to this, I talk too much. So I've seen people deliver bad news, get a player in the office, right, you're not playing tomorrow, I'm playing him, okay? I thought I'd tell you, out you go. I give him like a 3-hour chat, and in the end I could be talking about what their kids want for Christmas and anything. I just find myself sometimes when I'm in a position of being uncomfortable, I just talk more. So I definitely need to improve delivering bad news in a more succinct way, so the whole squad aren't on their third coffee waiting for the team meeting. So that would be something I think I need to improve on.
That is an amazing answer. Thanks for sharing your bowel movements as well.
Well, I just get it's adrenaline, isn't it? It's just get nervous.
Well, we said it was going to be a very honest insight into what it's going to be like to be a manager. Your final question is this, and I'm going to start with you, Alex. I want you to come up with one coach, past or present, living or dead, who, if you could, you'd bring them in to spend 10 minutes with your squad. Who would you pick?
I think I'll bring in Ralph Rennick. What he's done at clubs and the managers he's kind of influenced, and Nagelsmann and people, you know, you look at them, and I think that I would bring him in because he's changed the fortunes of so many clubs, and he's someone that, for me personally, I look at his interviews, I look at the way that his teams play, and the coaches that he's taught, and they're now the best in the world, some of the best managers in the world. So I would bring him in.
Okay, who's going next? Russ, do you want to go next? Who would you bring in 10 minutes with your squad?
Johan Cruyff.
Wow.
Really? Yeah.
For me. The sort of architect of Barcelona's success, everything that...
Yeah, we watched loads of videos of Holland back in the day and how they played, and he was still a player, but it's obviously very much influenced by him whilst he was still playing. I just think, he changed so many things about football, and he's an absolute idealist, which I love.
When were you born, if you don't mind me asking?
Me?
Yeah.
1986.
I'm trying to think of when... Johan Cruyff stopped playing football. He wasn't even in the 78 World Cup, was he? Did he not fall out with them? Oh, could be wrong on that. But wow, I love that stuff because those that have gone before don't get lost in the past. They do.
Well, yeah, I look at who he's influenced, and if you go back to the originator, the guy who set it all off, then he's probably the one to speak to, right?
Yeah, 100%. It's a bit like listening to a good album or something and then sort of tracing back the influences of the person that made it. And finally, Paul Warne.
Well, can I have three?
No.
Can I have three?
Why do you want three? Why is
one.
It
because... Why? One.
Well, okay, I would one. Go for... All right. I would go for Bill Belichick, Bobby Robson. Oh, that's two, isn't it? Sorry, mate, that's two. Two. I would go for if it was a footballer, I would like someone not football, truth be told. But I'll go with the theme. I'll go Bobby Robson because I thought he was way before his time, and I'm a Norwich fan and he was an Ipswich manager, so I'm more than respectful of the fact of who he is. But the fact that he coached abroad, and for people who are listening to this don't know how well he done abroad, was phenomenal what he did abroad for a time when not many English managers did do anything abroad. And just really because he was just a really great guy, a sincere guy, a really good person. If you watch any documentaries on him, and I know people always speak well of the past and that, the people who have passed, but just seemed a really good bloke who people would run through brick walls for. And it ain't about the shouting and the screaming, it's the way you treat people. And I think Bobby Robson was ahead of his time on many levels, so it'd be him for me.
Yeah, do you know what? And so humble as well. I worked a lot on the sort of northeast patch when Bobby was at Newcastle, and I got to know him, but at least I saw him once a week. And I was down working for Five Live on the 50th celebration of the Sports Personality of the Year Awards, and he came. He walked down the red carpet, but he went in the wrong direction. And I went, Bobby, the only way... And he saw me there. He went, oh, I think I've come the wrong way. I went, yeah, you're going to have to walk the entire length of the red carpet again. He was trying to avoid it like the plague. He just didn't want the adulation. He just wanted to slip through a back corridor and get round. Have you all learned something today? You're all sponges as managers. Russ, have you picked the odd bit and piece up from talking to the others, from listening to them?
Yeah, I love hearing about other managers' experiences. As Warnie said, you have to, whatever you feel about them when you play against them for 90 minutes, and it's always really, it can be quite tense. You have to respect what everyone's going through. We're all, everyone appreciates how difficult it is. But yeah, I always find Red's very good to talk to, and Warnie very, very interesting. So yeah, it's been good. And in a good way, Warnie, interesting in a good way.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Great to see you guys. I really appreciate you indulging us and giving us this insight into what goes on in those heads of yours. Great to see you guys. Thank you.
Great to see you. Thanks. See you guys.
Cheers.
All
see
the
ya.
Best.
Thank you. Thanks. All the best.
That is it for this special episode. A big thank you to Alex Ravel, to Paul Warne, and to Russell Martin. I hope you've just got a little insight into how things work from the other side of the fence. If you've enjoyed it, please do give us a 5-star rating, press the subscribe button, and share on your socials. If you'd like to get in touch, our email address is podcast@efl.com. That's podcast@efl.com. My name is Mark Clement. Thanks very much for listening. Join us again soon for another episode of
the official EFL podcast.